Tonight on Arena, Kevin Barry and Erin Monaghan on Kevin's new play, The Cave, and Rebecca Solnit urges positivity in her new book about the climate crisis. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. A man crawls out of a cave in South County Sligo on all fours, looking like, quote, he's after a night of the horrors. A second man appears, managing to, quote, stand up on his 2 feet. These are the brothers McRae, Bopper and Archie, as imagined by writer Kevin Barry, and soon to grace the stage of the Abbey Theatre in Kevin's new play, The Cave. Erin Monaghan is Bopper, Tommy Tiernan is Archie, and Judith Roddy is Helen, a Garda sergeant who has to deal with them. Delighted that both Kevin and Erin are with me in studio this evening. The old playwriting, Kevin, it's not absolutely brand new to you, and certainly collaborating with Katrina McLaughlin, the artistic director of the Abbey, is not new to you either. You had worked with her, on the pre-Derry Girls, Siobhan McSweeney.
Before Siobhan McSweeney found her world superstardom.
Which, of course, was all down to you
and overdue, yeah. Yeah, we did a play called Autumn Royal that Kat directed in 2017. We started it at the Everyman in Cork, and we had a tour the next year, then had a ball with it. And I had to kind of, around then, like, every few years I threaten people with a play. I don't actually write them, but I threaten them at one. I said, listen now, I'm going to write a play. So I get this notion, usually in between writing novels or something, that I go, oh, I know what, I'll rotate the crops, I'll write a play. And so you start looking for sets. As you walk around the place, I was trying to think where could I put a play now next.
And you were in a cave, I'm guessing.
I was up on Cache Hill, which is about five miles from where I live in South Sligo. Mad, primal, kind of eerie vibe. You know, these great caves, and standing outside it, thinking, "Wow, like that's a set.
Yeah,
now, that's a great set." You know, because it's what you're looking for with a set is something that's both kind of real and mythic
at
the same time. It could be two things, you know. And that was it. And I didn't have any characters for a while, but I wrote a page and a half. I squeezed
about the
cave, out of myself.
What the cave looked
of this,
like.
Of this great, this beautiful description of outside of a cave, and the wind is blowing in South Sligo. And Jesus, it was fabulous stuff, you know. But I'd no people
Mary,
for a long
Mary
time.
Mary, a character on stage, no, saying a word.
And I eventually went back to it. And I said, all right, I'll have to put someone in it, you know. There need to be actors. And a fella crawled out. And he was immediately crawling. He wasn't walking. Mm. So I said, okay, what's wrong with him?
Right.
And then another fella walked out. And I said, that must be the brother. And you start it really simple like that.
Yeah.
You say, okay, there's two brothers. And I do, my writing often, I have a tendency towards double acts. As a starting point, at
Night,
least.
Night, Bolt and Tangiers.
Yeah,
there's
been a few.
There. Yeah.
My writing falls into those rhythms. Almost a kind of a music hall or vaudeville.
There is a touch of that often, isn't there? Sort of vaudeville.
Where these two kind of start playing off each other. And all the story tends to be going on underneath the surface of the talk.
Yeah.
It's not so much what they're saying as what they're not saying, almost. And that was how Archie and Bopper kind of came to me first.
Archie, even those names... Iron Archie and Bopper. You're Bopper. Is the age difference important here? Is it important who's older and who's younger?
Oh, I haven't given too much away, Sean, about my own age and Tommy Tiernan's age.
Of course, age and playing age are two totally different
absolutely,
things.
Absolutely. And it'll be down to the, I'm sure, the Abbey hair and makeup department to help us out with
sort
that.
Yeah.
I think they're very much of a... They're very much of the same era. They seem to be kind of stuck in a world of the 70s, 80s and grew up in the 90s. It's in a funny way, it is all in the names. Archie is a very Archie character, and Bopper. Bopper's called Bopper because he was born to bop. that's all I can say about
Which
it.
Which is why you were cast, Erin,
absolutely.
Clearly.
I like to do a bit of movement, you know.
Bopper has had some kind of life outside of the McRae family. Even I love the name McRae as well. I don't know where that came from.
There's something scaldy about it, isn't
there?
They say Bopper has some sort of a life. He certainly had a heyday back in 1995, but he keeps on harking back to it, and that seems to be the sort of the zenith of his life. And I think it says something that 30 years later he's still harking back to that time when he was royal in love and things were going good for him, but he also doesn't want to have to live through 1996 again, where it all went wrong.
Broken heart.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to give too much away.
We need go any further than that. However, you see, when as Aaron describes the characters there, Kevin, you know, you can, this is a kind of a timeless thing. It's two fellas up the side of a hill in rural County Sligo, somewhere in the west, but it is rural County Sligo, Leitrim, that your area of the country. And they're trapped in time. But these boys are not totally trapped in time. There's a lot of discussion about the nature of the mobile phone signal. Will they be able to get it? And more importantly, Netflix. And I spent far too much of my day today searching for Elvira Martinez, the Mexican actress on Netflix. Is there an Elvira Martinez in some series here on Netflix?
Like the two
lads. She's mentioned, we should say. She's a character that's
mentioned. The lads have a kind of, I suppose you could call it a dangerous obsession with Elvira Martinez, who they've come across somehow on the Netflix, you know, and their big problem is they can't get a proper signal.
Up
near the cave, so they can't keep up with what's happening with Elvira on her socials and all of that. So they're a bit freaked out by this. But it's kind of like, and like you can always say after you've written something what it's about, and it can be true or it can be waffle, you know. But it does seem to me after having written this play, it's about the way the life and the daily texture of life has changed in rural Ireland where I live in South Sligo in the last 16 years since I moved there. I'm 17 years in Sligo. And the big change is the phones, you know. In 2007, we weren't all staring into these things all day, every day, all the time. And the capture is total and everyone's at it. And these lads are... And what starts to happen is the whole perception of reality breaks down. And what's real and what's not real and what world are we in? And all these things start to get very kind of... melty at the edges, you know, and the lads are very, very caught up in this. So, like, this is a play of rural Sligo, but it's a play of rural Sligo in a very new way, I hope, that tries to go into this total immersion that we're in now in the digital world and what it's doing to us. And it's kind of, it's weirdly hard to write about, you know, because we're all so immersed in it and the digital thing has taken over to such a degree. It can be like trying to write about a little tree when you're in the middle of a forest, you know. It's all around you. It's ever present and it's changing everything about how we see, how we hear, how our minds work. So to go in and find a story to pin it on and to try and dramatise this very dramatic change in our lives takes a while. I've been trying to get at it a bit in stories and here and there in novels and stuff. This text, this play, the Cave, feels to me like the first time I'm starting to get somewhere with it in terms of the sheer derangement of it.
Yeah, because
of what it's doing to people.
There is no question. You did not sit down and say, I'm going to write a play now about social media and its ills in modern contemporary Ireland. But the minute you put the telephone into the hands of those two characters, it's going to be that's going to be present.
And writers are terrified of it, of putting a phone in their story or putting the internet in, because it just changes everything.
Yeah,
you know. And we're only coming to terms with how you start to dramatise this world, you know, which is kind of resistant to it because it's all this white noise of technology everywhere. But you have to, you know, this is really fundamental change in the place and in the people, and you have to try and tackle it in some way and say what's happening,
what's going on there, and that is a very important aspect of it for sure. The other thing that struck me was what you can do when you're writing a play that you can't do when you're writing a novel or a story. I'm reading the stage directions for the beginning of scene 2. The Elvira Martinez situation. This is where we first hear about Elvira and the obsession of the two lads with her. It's dusk. A charismatic glow to the light, Archie approaches the van, almost collapsing under the ladder as if it's a cross that he bears. He attempts to place the stepladder on top of the van. An amount of fierce messing ensues as he tries to achieve this. Now I know it's the character of Archie who does that, Aaron, but I'm sure I could pick up another section where Bopper is doing something similar. This incredible physical demand, but, you know, a sentence like, an amount of fierce messing ensues. When you're trying to realise that kind of physicality in the rehearsal room, how have you been going about that? Because Kevin has said, there you go, guys, you're the actors and the director.
It's a very dangerous thing for a writer to give to any actor, especially someone like Tommy Tiernan or myself. It's glorious. I mean, we were talking about this in rehearsals earlier on today, that it's not just a stage direction where the character goes stage left and opens the door or something like that. You've written these beautiful stage directions with texture to them, Kevin, and they kind of contextualise not just what the character's doing, but what they're feeling as well. And it just gives that added dimension. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. And you realise that, I mean, apart from the fact that it's hilariously funny in terms of its what the characters say, but some of the situations that they find themselves in, the fact that they're up a mountain in Sligo and they've somehow managed to get a van up there and they're trying to fix it and then they can't get a signal, and the fact that they're addicted to their phones and they're as far away from the signal as is humanly possible. It's just epically funny from the get-go. So we're having a lot of fun with it.
And also, I mean, Kevin's mentioned that vaudevillian aspect of things, that the two-hander, the two male characters, you know, they're all over. You can pick a million and one playwrights. You've got Casey, Beckett, which all of whom you've been involved in recent times. Realising those physical aspects of things, you know, I suppose you could spend a morning rehearsing that one little sentence of a stage direction and come out with 40 seconds or a minute of action if you're lucky.
Oh, we have. And I mean, yeah, there's a beautiful theme in the play that I think you can kind of go through where, as you say, one is crawling out of the cave and the other is walking out.
Yeah.
And without giving too much away, I think those physical journeys kind of cross each other, and it feels like the opposite of the ascent of man, where it starts off as a sort of a noose, becoming a primate and a gorilla and a Neanderthal man, and there's a beautiful journey in that, and there's the opposite journey to play with too, without getting too philosophical.
Yes, and I suppose, again, I doubt very much that you were sitting at the desk going, "Oh, I'll have these mirroring journeys."
Well, do you know, I'm really, and like Aaron touched on it there, the most important thing for me is to be having fun at the desk and to give myself a good time. And like a play script is an invitation to actors and director and crew to say, you know, have as good a time as you can with it. So I try to be generous in the directions. But like we were just to say, we're talking about it as a two-hander.
I was just going to say, we should mention that this isn't just a two-hander. A very
important
character.
It kind of came to life for me when this guard kept showing up, the local band
played
guard
by Judith Roddy, played by Judith,
and she somehow earthed the play for me and made it a real story, you know, and took it out of the music hall, if you like, when she came into it. And
it also we learned that very much 21st century rural Ireland. It pins it down.
Yeah, and we learn without giving anything away that she is closely entangled in the brothers' lives, and it just kind of brought it to a new place for me when she appeared.
What has the process been like for you? I mean, you know, you write a novel, you go through the editing process, then you sign off on it, and off it goes flying off out into the world, and you kind of, you don't see it or feel it, I guess, in a peculiar type of way. Well, a play is different. You're in the rehearsal process now, for example. How involved are you in that?
I'm up and down a bit, in for a few days now at the start, kind of a thing, but I'll leave them at it now, because I've to go back up to my shed and write more stuff. But it's like, I love the sociability. It's a lovely change from book writing, where it's yourself for a year in a room with the book. I like having colleagues for a while. It's nice, you know. But yeah, it's the terrifying aspect, I suppose, if somebody doesn't like your short story or your novel, you're not generally sitting in the same room with them at the time. But if they don't like your play, you might be.
Yeah.
So there is that. But I think we'll have a ball with it.
The other aspect of this is on the first day of a reading of a script, everybody sits down around the table. Obviously, Aaron plays his character of Bopper. Tommy Tiernan plays his character of Archie. Judith Brody plays her character of this guard, the sergeant. I'm presuming Kevin Barry is a man who is known to read characters out loud. You got to read the stage directions, or did you?
I have done it one of the readings. We've had a couple, yeah. And I try not to be stealing any thunder from our great actors, you know. So it's probably better off to keep me away from them in a way. Mm.
The South Sligo setting, or the setting of it, how important is that that rural aspect? Not just rural, but you know, the specifics of Sligo, Leitrim, that area of the country. How important is that to you as an actor, Aaron?
Huge. I mean, it roots it in a very real place. Mm. I wasn't aware that the caves were a real place, but it feels very much that sort of West Cavan, Leitrim, Sligo area, and the fact that it's just outside a town as well. We were talking at rehearsals, you know, it's not, there's a very big difference between city and the country, and the town is in the middle of that. And, you know, these are lads are kind of
and
run out.
And this cave is up looking down on the town.
Looking down on it. And they're both run out of it, and they're part of it, and they don't want to be part of it as well. So, it feels very particular Midwest Ireland's edge of town.
And the other aspect of it, I mean, I touched on it there earlier, Kevin, about, and I hope I'm not giving anything away by saying this, the van does move at a certain point along the way. The van is in motion. Again, a wonderful thing to write in a stage direction.
Yeah.
Did you kind of enjoy the madcap freedom of, I don't have to work out how this happens, I'm just saying.
I mean, it's the great thing with a play, you know, you set a problem for your collaborators on the page and say, figure that out now, and what can we do? And often they look at it and go, can't do it. But then, oh, hang on, what if we try this? You know what I mean? And that's the magic of it, I suppose, and see what they come up with.
And on the subject of caves, didn't you spend time in a cave with the aforementioned Tommy Tiernan in his documentary about the West and the arts in the West?
Yeah, well, Tommy and I had a conversation in a cave, and I had written the first draft of this, and you try not to think of any particular actors because chances are you won't get them and they won't be available and stuff. But as he was interviewing me for this show, I was looking at him and I was going, Jesus, Tommy looks great in a cave. I don't know what it is, but this just looks right now. And he started going into my head that as a possible McRae.
Whichever. And I guess there is a kind of, I'm not saying they're interchangeable, but it would be interesting to see. I put a task up to you now, Aaron, you and Tommy, interchange those parts to see what that would bring. Because there is, when the two brothers like that, it's not that one of them's, you know, loquacious and the other one's saying nothing. They have certain similarities.
No, I think they're for me anyway, they seem like two sides of the same coin, or whatever that phrase is. I mean, there's times in rehearsals you're putting the book down and you're finishing each other's sentences as well. That's not my line, but you know, it's that's Kevin's.
Well, listen, best of luck to both of you with it. The Cave by Kevin Barry, with Aaron Monaghan, Judith Roddy and Tommy Tiernan. Previews at the Abbey Theatre from the 6th of June, opens on the 13th, runs through until the 18th of July. It's also at the Galway International Arts Festival from the 22nd through to the 26th. Full details on abbeytheatre.ie and giaf.ie. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Rebecca Solnit is the author of more than 20 books, including Orwell's Roses, Recollections of My Non-Existence and Men Explain Things to Me. Her latest book, No Straight Road Takes You There, explores the climate crisis, women's rights and the fight for democracy from a clear-eyed, positive point of view. I'm delighted that Rebecca Solnit joins me from Seattle, where she is currently on a book tour. And I'm wondering, when I use the word positive in and around climate crisis, it's not necessarily what we think of when lots of people think of when they think of the climate crisis. But you have a kind of I'm careful about the word I might use here, a hopefulness perhaps around the climate crisis and the solution to it.
I would be happy to be called hopeful as long as we distinguish hopeful from optimistic. I always say optimism, like pessimism and doomerism, assumes we know exactly what's going to happen, which means it's preordained and nothing is required of us. Whereas hope is just a sense of possibilities and therefore a responsibility to seize them and try and realize the best ones and forestall the worst ones.
In fact, that lovely word that you use in one of the essays, evitable, the opposite of inevitable. Evitable is a great word. Does it exist as an actual word or is that your own little invention?
So when I was very young, I read a P.G. Wodehouse novel in which they come up with the word gruntled, which is the opposite, of course, of disgruntled. And so I've loved decoupling these words from the prefixes that make them negatives. Therefore, if you can have gruntled, surely you can have evitable.
OK, I am gruntled at your choice of word evitable then, if that makes sense. I'm looking at the book's title, Rebecca, No Straight Road Takes You There. Long-sightedness is one of the themes that comes up again and again across the essays, but nowhere more so even in the title of the essay, Tortoise at the Mayfly Party. Talk to us a little bit about that idea of long-sightedness and what exactly you mean by that.
I see so much despair and defeatism, a sense we never change anything or nothing will ever change. The world is static or maybe just deteriorating, comes from a kind of amnesia, a lack of memory just over anybody's lifetime who's more than a quarter century old over maybe. When did marriage equality pass in your country, abortion rights? And, so I feel like I see time in bigger chunks, partly as somebody who reads a lot, somebody who's talked to older people, somebody who's just wildly enthused about knowing and tracing these long trajectories of change. There was a period where people liked to tell me that feminism had achieved nothing, which is an astonishingly clueless thing. If you have if you have any idea of what the status of women was in, say, 1960, how radically different women are in much of the world now in terms of rights, equality, participation in civil society, government, education, law, medicine, and everything else. And so the long perspective gives you power. Memory is a superpower, and it's available to almost all of us, but not particularly encouraged by social media and a lot of the discourse around us.
And that aspect of social media, and in fact, you talk about even the news, the contemporary news. We look at the 6 o'clock bulletin or whatever particular news bulletin we look at, and we have this 24-hour news cycle. That kind of short-term aspect of what happens today, what's going to happen tomorrow because of what happened today, are you encouraging us to stay away from that?
I think I just want context with it. And US news media and the mainstream so often thinks it's somehow biased or unnecessary to give context. And so they give these bald facts of something that just happened without telling us how we got here, whether it's a deterioration or a triumph of organizing or anything else. And it particularly dismisses the people at the beginning of all the positive social changes. At the very end, politicians, governments, powerful people ratify a decision, whether it's marriage equality or climate action. That happens at the end of the process. At the beginning of the process are grassroots campaigns, people who are often dismissed, people on the margins who are out of the limelight, who launch these new ideas, this new sense of what's just and possible. And they get written out of those stories when it's what happened yesterday rather than the long road, the long and not necessarily straight road to how this thing happened yesterday.
And that links into another idea that I really enjoyed, that you talk about success without victory, which is, it's not quite the same as, pick your battles and don't try to win the war in one battle. But success without victory is a wonderful way of putting it.
Yeah, Jules Lobel from the Center for Constitutional Rights, a really important organization in the U.S., uses that term because they would often go to court and they wouldn't always win, but the whole process would broaden the conversation, educate the public, maybe lay groundwork for victory later, shift something somewhere else, inspire a legislature. There's so many ways that things can have an impact, a good and useful impact, that are not necessarily the short-term immediate, we demanded it on Tuesday and we got it on Wednesday, which often seems like a lot of people's criterion for victory, which leaves a lot of people disappointed when it doesn't work quite like that. Not that I have anything against short, simple, immediate, and obvious. Hmm. It's just not necessarily how change works. And understanding the slower, more complex, less predictable ways and all the glorious indirect consequences, and sometimes the terrible ones, I think is part of just understanding change so we can participate in it.
And I wonder to what extent that's even down to, and since one of the primary focuses, no doubt, of the book, I think, is this idea of the climate crisis that we are currently in, without doubt, how success without victory can come speak to the individual. You know, if I choose not to drive my car in to work today, but to cycle in today, the climate crisis isn't going to end tomorrow because of that. But small little actions can become cumulatively, they can add up.
It's funny, I was just thinking about cycling, because one of the obstacles we face with climate is that people think we need some magic, gee whiz, powerful new technology, when a lot of the solutions are very simple. Eat less red meat and maybe less meat altogether, more bicycles, more good public transit, better design so we're not so reliant on cars, heat pumps and electrify everything. The real obstacles we face are not technological. We have the solutions, some of which are very basic, some of which are wonderful new wind and solar technologies and networks. The obstacles are political, the fossil fuel industry and the politicians in cahoots with them. So we all need to do all those good things we always hear about with our climate footprints, but we also need movements more powerful than those obstacles to overcome them and implement the fairly glorious future if we do what the climate requires of us. It doesn't have to be austere and sacrifice the way it's often portrayed. It could be all kinds of abundance we don't talk about enough, an abundance of hope, of confidence in the future, of health when we no longer have the incredible poisonousness of fossil fuel at every stage, an abundance of good politics when we take fossil fuel geopolitics out of the global equation. You know, so many good things could come if we do what we need to do and we know how to do.
I wondered about that that phrase, success without victory. So sideways off the climate crisis, a crisis that you must face on a regular day, on a daily basis, the crisis of what word is next, what sentence is next. Do you have to think in those ways, a small success, without a big victory on the daily basis when you're sitting at, on a daily basis when you're sitting at your desk?
Oh, writing is a bunch of being diligent and mostly you're trudging and then occasionally you suddenly have wings and can fly 100 miles in an afternoon and not touch the ground. But it's a diligent application. And really, political activism is the same thing. You know, you build the movement, you show up, you do all these things that can seem quite tedious and boring and full of tiny increments of achievement. And then suddenly, something happens, as it did at Occupy Wall Street, as it did with the summer after George Floyd was murdered by the police, as it does when it's, I feel like sometimes it's like piling the fuel for a bonfire, but it's lightning that's going to ignite it. No fuel, no bonfire, but you don't get to be the lightning exactly, or you can't predict when it will strike. So you can prepare without really knowing. And unpredictability, which for me is really kind of synonymous with possibility in both the best and worst senses, is also part of my hopefulness.
One of the most elegant essays in the book for me is A Truce with Trees, which is about a violin made in 1721 being played today, three centuries on. And it, I suppose it touches on this the important aspect of how, yes, we can use resources. Obviously, it's made of trees. the cutting down of trees were involved in making this violin. But we can have luxuries like that without destroying the planet.
Yeah, there's a real sense that all our well-being depends on this kind of hyper-consumeristic industrialization, and to recognize that we had great culture great civilization before the Industrial Revolution in many ways was one of the things David Harrington's 1721 violin suggested to me, that, you know, a pound of organic materials could make extraordinary music for millions of people over 300 years. Kronos Quartet, which David leads, just played at a climate benefit I helped organize, so that violin has actually helped the climate cause with Oil Change International, kind of fulfilling what I was talking about in that essay. But also, I see the climate crisis as our war against nature, and specifically against the plant kingdom and trees, because plants produce oxygen, sequester carbon, stabilize atmosphere and the temperature of the planet. Burning up all this fossil fuel, which was carbon buried by plants in earlier eons, is really taking stuff where it, out of where it belongs in the ground, and keep it in the ground is a big climate motto, and throwing it back up in the sky where the, you know, where it doesn't belong, where the trees and other plants removed it all those millions and billions of years ago. So yeah, I see climate as a war against the trees, and the possibility of a truce with the trees as what it could be if we really get it right.
Again, a lot of hopefulness in there. However, when I look, and when many people look at your own country today, to find hopefulness within many of the things that are happening there is very difficult. Do you find it difficult to do so? What are your hopes around your own country and how it might change or develop from where it's at now?
Well, one of the fun things to say about the Trump administration is it prompted Canada to elect the progressive rather than the conservative candidate, Australia to do the same, and arguably the conclave, they just had to pick a half-Black American pope who very recently directly told Vance and Trump, well, a lot of things I can't really say on the radio, I think. And so, you know, in a sense, the new right-wing authoritarianism is a backlash against racial justice, gender justice, feminism, environmentalism, etc. But even a backlash can have a backlash, and there is a possibility. We don't know where it will go, because it's up to us to make these positive changes to be more impactful than them. So it's horrific. And the damage to lives, to a functioning federal government, to climate action, to human rights, to things like AIDS care in Africa is already horrific, already devastating. But the story doesn't end there. There's, you know, the U.S. was a mess before January 20th, 2025. I am not the last to admit, which is what made all this possible, including U.S. mainstream media, you know, voter suppression, et cetera. If we come out of this better, we will essentially be inventing a better country, I think, rather than reverting to the one we've just lost, which is daunting, but not impossible.
And very hopeful. Rebecca Solnit, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
My pleasure. See you all in Dublin in a few weeks.
Absolutely. You will see Rebecca in Dublin in a few weeks. She is appearing at this year's International Literature Festival Dublin in Merrion Square at 8 p.m. on Friday the 23rd of May. You'll find out full details on ilfdublin.com. And Rebecca's new book is called No Straight Road Takes You There. It's published by Granta. The 13th Dublin International Piano Competition continues throughout this week in the city, building up to the grand finale on Friday the 16th of May, when three finalists will compete at the National Concert Hall in an event that will be broadcast live on RTE Lyric FM. The musicians will perform concertos accompanied by the National Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Jonas Alber. Earlier today, I was joined in the wonderful Studio 8 in the RTE Radio Centre by the renowned Australian concert pianist Piers Lane, who is one of the judges for this year's Dublin International Piano Competition. Before we had our chat, though, he treated me to a performance of a Chopin waltz. Here's Lynn performing Chopin's C sharp minor waltz, Opus 64, number 2. Now, delighted that Piers is with us in studio with that waltz in C minor, the Dublin International Piano Competition taking place this week, and Piers is one of the judges. Before we get into the competition itself, Chopin and the piano by itself, which is what some of these competitors had to do in the early rounds. They just had to play by themselves. Chopin, he gives you everything as a pianist, but I guess that also means he challenges you to do everything as a pianist.
That's for sure. Yes, it's interesting. There's not that much Chopin in the competition. Mm. And that surprises me in a way, because Chopin's the ultimate piano composer, isn't he? You know, he knows how to make the piano sing.
I mean, you're playing that for us live here in Studio 8 in RTE. I suppose pieces like that, you have to have them constantly on your fingers. Do you have to keep that repertoire alive? You can't just say, oh, I'll do that next week. I'll play it once or twice before I go in. Do you have to keep it going all the time?
You can't always. Life gets in the way, you know. Mm. I was rung up by Finneen Collins last week to take over a concert for Music for Galway, because one of the judges, the American Anne-Marie McDermott, had to pull out for health reasons. And he asked if I could take over a concert on Tuesday night. And I had a different program in London on Monday, but decided to do all the nocturnes of Chopin for Galway. But, you know, had to get on a bus, plane, first of all, in the morning, and get over to Dublin, and then 2.5 hour bus ride. There wasn't much time to rehearse. So
you can't bring the piano on the bus with you.
You can't take the piano on the bus. And since then, you know, we've been judging for the last 3 days, from early in the morning until dinner time, and then taken out to wonderful dinners and that sort of thing. You get home to the hotel late and exhausted, and there's no opportunity to practice. So, you know, we have to be very flexible, particularly as pianists. I'm always jealous of violinists and flautists and so on. They can warm up until they go on stage, and we often can't find a keyboard to practice on.
And I guess that's part of the challenge in this competition that we're talking about, you know, for the young pianists who are preparing for it here. Those who get, the three who will get to the final, have to have all that repertoire ready. You know, they played solo in the first round. I think they played solo in the quarterfinals. And now in the semifinals, which are coming up, they have to play a solo piece and a piece with the contemporary quartet, a quintet.
That's right. And not only a solo piece. I mean, it's a good, I think it's 40 minutes program again, which they have just played in the quarterfinal and, of course, before. So a lot of solo repertoire, enough to prove that they got over one recital's worth of repertoire at their command. And yes, it's quite a different thing to play a piano quintet. Some of them won't be very experienced playing chamber music. It's become a requisite thing in international competitions for quite a few years now. So they expect to have to do it. But it's tough because, you know, when they're students at conservatoires and so on, they're not necessarily, they don't have access necessarily to quartets to play with and to warm up with and that sort of thing. So it'll be interesting to see how they cope. Of course, the contempo are very, very experienced, and they might carry some of them along if necessary as well.
Yeah, I wondered about that, and I wondered the same thing when the three finalists get to the point. So Tuesday and Wednesday are the days when the four semi-finalists on Tuesday, four semi-finalists on Wednesday, they will be playing the quintets with contempo. Then the three finalists will be chosen, and they go forward to the National Concert Hall and they play with the National Symphony Orchestra a concerto, a set number of concertos that they can choose from. For many of these young pianists, the intimidation of being on a National Concert Hall stage with a National Symphony Orchestra, it demands a lot.
It's huge, and being live streamed, you know, around the world at the same time. Yes, enormous pressure. In some ways, it's good to be only 18 because you don't succumb to that pressure in the same way, perhaps, as you do when you're 22 or 23 and feeling that bit older and very responsible, you know.
22 or 23 years old now for a pianist, well, is it?
Do you know, it's interesting. I've been judging quite a few international competitions, and the age does seem to be getting lower for when people are having enormous success. I mean, Van Cliburn was won last time by an 18-year-old. You know, to have the repertoire and the emotional maturity to cope with career demands at that age, it's huge.
And when you're listening as a judge, I mean, obviously you're listening to technicalities and...
Look, you can almost take the technicalities for granted.
They're going to be able to play.
They're going to be able to play amazingly.
So are you looking for some kind of extra artistry, some kind of interpretive nuance?
You're looking for somebody who really communicates something different, has something different to offer. And I mean, it is a subjective thing. Mm. That's why we have a panel of seven judges. It has to be a majority decision. I mean, we just put down the names that we want through and then we see who has got the majority of votes.
It's subjective for you as well when it came to choosing your music this morning. You've played us a Chopin waltz. You're going to play us a Chopin nocturne. Now, I have to say, John Field, of course, is important in terms of the nocturne, but Chopin really moved the form to a new place. This piece that you're going to play for us, is there something about this particular nocturne?
Well, it is a glorious one, I think. They're all wonderful. You know, I've played all of them recently quite a lot. I did 13 recitals throughout New Zealand of all the nocturnes each time. And so I have a great affection for all of them. But the D-flat one I've probably played more than any other. I have used it as an encore in places as well. You know, it's a piece that appeals in a concert hall very much, I think.
Yeah, and after a very flashy piece, I can imagine how this would quieten things down for people to hear the subtleties of Chopin. I'll let you make your way to the piano, Piers, and we will now listen to Piers Lane playing us the D-flat Nocturne of Frédéric Chopin, Opus 27, number 2.
Thank you.
Some days you'd have to pinch yourself. That's what you have to do when you go to work. That was Australian pianist Piers Lane playing us that Nocturne in D flat by Frédéric Chopin. As I said, he's in the midst of judging the semi-finals of the Dublin International Piano Competition this evening. So he did that for us earlier today. He sat down at the piano, warmed up for 5 or 10 minutes, and then just played like that. Straight off, one take, that was it. Thank you very much, let's go with that. Astonishing stuff indeed. He is one of the judges for the final of the for the Dublin International Piano Competition. You can watch the final of that competition this coming Friday from 7 p.m. via RTE Culture, and it'll be broadcast live on RTE Lyric FM. Earlier rounds are also accessible on the Dublin International Piano Competition YouTube channel, and you can find out full details of tickets and information and everything happening there on DIPC.ie. Let me tell you a little bit about tomorrow night on the programme. Rosamund Pike and Matthew Rhys will be talking about the film Hollow Road. Mike Finn, playwright, will be talking about his play The Rising of the Women. This is the story of a group of women in Limerick, in fact, who were employed as extras on the Jordan Ford film The Rising of the Moon, but he bit off more than he could chew. They went on strike for better pay, and Mike Finn's play tells us that story. That will be tomorrow night on the programme. But that is our lot for this Monday evening. Jamie Doyle was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Research this evening was by Leah Murphy, and the programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1. And coming up after the 8 o'clock news, I do believe John Creedon is back in the seat.